From 1944 to 1946, as the world pivoted from the Second World War to an unsteady peace, Americans in more than 200 cities and towns mobilized to chase an impossible dream. The newly created United Nations needed a meeting place, a central place for global diplomacy, a capital of the world. And that is the title of the new book by Charlene Myers, Capital of the World, The Race to Host the United Nations. Charlene Myers is Associate Professor of History at Rutgers University, Camden, and it's a great pleasure to welcome her to the roundtable.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
When we look at this race, it is fascinating of what was at stake, because many people thought that, obviously it's the global meeting place. At what point did it become an opportunity for all of these localities to be the capital of the world?
Well, that's a wonderful question, because the cities and towns of the United States began to sniff out this opportunity before the United Nations even existed. The UN was organized at the end of World War II, and as plans began to be made, cities and towns across the country viewed this as both an opportunity of local prestige, and as a way to continue to contribute to the nation's efforts as they had in war, now to secure peace for the world.
When you think of what the opportunities were, at what point was it thought of as being a capital of the world? That, I mean, its importance was seen right away.
Yes. The United Nations, of course, was searching for a place to put its headquarters. But in the popular imagination, it was a capital of the world. And that was a phrase that had come into use by the middle of the 20th century to refer to places where diplomats met. But I think it gained new traction after the end of the Second World War, in the wake of victory and the very deep concern over how to prevent another war from occurring, that to think of this as something bigger and grander fit into the level of concern that people had, as well as the level of determination that Americans had to continue to be world players, even if that were from a very local position.
You write in the introduction of the book that the world capital idea also began to take shape physically during the late 19th and early 20th centuries. World fairs, which began with the Crystal Palace exhibition in London. The Olympic Games were revived in their modern form, you write, in 1896, and they transformed their host cities. So this was kind of the idea they were going for.
Very much. And this is particularly true of New York, which had hosted the 1939 World's Fair in Queens, right in Flushing Meadow. I think many of your listeners will be familiar with that location. That, in the case of New York, became the place that they began to promote as the future home for the United Nations. But they were not alone in making a connection between places that had been World's Fairs and where the UN might be. The same was true in Chicago, which offered a peninsula off of downtown, which had been a World's Fairgrounds. It was true of San Francisco. It was true of Philadelphia. So I think those places had become remembered as world gathering places. And some of the speculative plans that architects began to develop also looked very much like World's Fairs, with national pavilions, for example, as meeting places.
What is fascinating, and you talk about this in the book, that the idea struck cities, Chicago, St. Louis, San Francisco, Denver, New Orleans, and many towns and cities in between, looking for that opportunity, but they did so without any invitation. No one was really asking them to do this.
Exactly. Once the opportunity took root and became reported in newspapers, one town after another began to send to the United Nations or to the President of the United States or to their congressman or to John D. Rockefeller their proposals for the capital of the world, and most often this meant offering their own hometowns. So there was never an invitation, there was never an organized competition. The United Nations, by the time it became fully operational, had piles of letters and telegrams and huge ornate brochures beseeching their attention. Among the more than 200 of these that eventually accumulated, there were 16 particularly energetic booster teams that flew from the United States to London, where the UN was first becoming organized, to make a personal pitch. They had never been invited. In fact, the United States State Department encouraged them not to go. But they were so determined to take this opportunity and not to miss the chance that they went to that extreme of effort in order to get the UN's attention.
Meanwhile, New York, the one thing is, and you point this out, that the one thing that the UN decided on very early on is that they didn't want to be in New York.
Absolutely not. They did not want to be in New York. And that had to do with several factors just in general about how they were imagining what the UN would be. It was hoped in the beginning that the United Nations might be a capital of the world, and that is that it would be a freestanding place, a very large sort of international zone. And it was feared that to put that too close to a city would be to lose the UN's identity as it was first getting going. And knowing that cities were growing in this era, there was a fear that the UN would just become subsumed into a city. In the case of New York, they did decide they would like to be within a general radius of New York, so in order to take advantage of the cultural amenities, the universities, and so on. But they also drew a line saying we will not go any closer than, it was 25 miles, and so they did not intend to be any closer than 25 miles to New York. That totally took off the table for a time, the New Yorkers' offer of the World's Fairgrounds in Flushing Meadow.
When you think of that decision, it seems that it was always, was America always on the table?
In the beginning, the first decision to be made was, would the United Nations make its place? And it was a lengthy and bitterly fought debate. Europe had always been the center of diplomacy throughout the 20th century, in any case. So to remove it was to make a statement about where the world's future lay. And to choose the United States meant turning away from, for example, the home of the League of Nations in Geneva, which had not been finished for so long, but was seen as a result of World War II as being sort of a symbol of ineffectiveness. And so that there was a choice to be made. The choice was made for the United States, and at that point, the question became where in the U.S.
One of the local connections in the story, which is fascinating, and I had no idea that one of the proposed sites was Hyde Park, was the home of FDR.
Exactly, promoted, by the way, by the people of Poughkeepsie nearby. So it was a booster campaign, and of course, the symbolism of Franklin Roosevelt was the argument to bring it there, and they did. Put quite an effort, and the UN site selection team did visit Hyde Park. They drew their radius around New York for searching at exactly the right point that would allow them to go and consider Hyde Park. However, you know, Franklin Roosevelt was also a controversial figure, and so had they chosen Hyde Park, there would have been resistance as well as acceptance. And the size of territory that they were looking for would have meant a substantial change for the communities around the Roosevelt estate. So as time went by, there was also some questioning and resistance that developed. So while the UN visited there, it did not come forward as one of the chief contenders.
One of the chapters in your book is entitled Stumble, and it's reflective on the fact that there were a lot of stumbling blocks along the way. This was by no means an easy process.
Not at all. I mean, the extent of interest in the United States was remarkable, but the United States government was taking a stance of neutrality. So they were leaving it up to the United Nations to decide. And the diplomatic corps that had been based in Europe for so long did not have a great deal of familiarity with the United States. They acted, first of all, by thinking of the United States in terms of regions and decided that anywhere west of the Mississippi River would be too far away for diplomats traveling from Europe, that the Midwest was too isolationist, and that the South was too prone to racial discrimination. So they sliced down their options in that way, leading them to the Northeast. But still, they came on a very quick inspection tour in January of 1946. And remarkably enough, with all of the interest that had been shown around the country, decided upon a site in what must have been one of the few places anywhere in the nation that did not want to become the capital of the world.
And that was?
And that was Greenwich, Connecticut. Greenwich is, of course, a suburban area north of New York City. There was open countryside there. It was and is a beautiful location. It was within commuting distance of New York. But Greenwich had never invited the United Nations to come there. And that became an issue that for this time after World War II, who should decide the fate of a town? And there was an argument made in Greenwich and in some places around Boston as well, where the UN also was taking a look, that it should be up to local people to determine their fate. Would the United Nations coming in create too much of a change in the character of a town? And I think this is especially important for the time after World War II, when towns like Greenwich and others within the suburban orbits of large cities were seeing themselves become more like suburbs and less like freestanding towns. One of the remarkable things about Greenwich is the town meeting there, which met to discuss these issues, was presided over by none other than Prescott Bush, the father and grandfather of future presidents. So this is a story that crosses in surprising ways into many lives, both of everyday people and those who became more prominent.
So who looked at the 17 acres on the East River of New York, the site of smelly slaughterhouses, and said, that's our spot?
Yeah, why not, right? Wouldn't it be perfect? It was actually a real estate developer. I think your listeners have probably heard of the Zeckendorf real estate development firm. William Zeckendorf read in the newspaper about the UN's difficulties in locating a site. And he read the paper, he turned to his wife, he said, I'm going to put them over there. He had already assembled the properties on the East River for another project that would have been somewhat similar to Rockefeller Center. And at a time when the UN was facing this resistance in suburban New York and was temporarily located on the World's Fair site in Queens, a deal came together very quickly for the site on the East River. And it involved the boosters for New York City, who all along had been coaxing the UN toward New York despite its original resistance. And the deal was clinched by Nelson Rockefeller, who was on this committee, who phoned his father, John D. Rockefeller Jr., and his father offered the gift of $8.5 million in order to purchase that property in Manhattan, where the UN headquarters stands today.
It is a fascinating story. The name of the book is Capital of the World, The Race to Host the United Nations. The book is published by NYU Press. Charlene Myers, thank you very much for spending time with us. I appreciate you sharing the story.
Oh, thank you so much.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the name of the book, Capital of the World, The Race to Host the United Nations. It's published by New York University Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.